Okay. So it was the people's request in Numbers, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 21 or 22, that they go into the land, spy it out. Well, they brought this to Moses. Moses said, that's a good idea. Moses takes it to God. God says, okay. And he allows them to go and says, pick out for you 12 men. And he names them here in chapter 13 of who is going, the spies are. So, he says in verse 17, go up into the Negev, then go up into the hill country. Turns out they go, you know, they cover all the land. Now, debatable whether they stay in a group or they split up or what they do, but they go in and they look at the land, and see everything. They go very far up into near the northern part where we consider Dan when we, you know, where that territory winds up being, up near Mount Hermon. They go, you know, north, they go all through it. And they, on the way back, they come through a place that they name Eshcol. And they name it Eshcol because it means cluster. And they cut off a big, huge, honking cluster of grapes, have to carry it on poles. They bring it back. So they come back to give their report. How long are they gone there? Gone for 40 days, all right? So they're gone 40 days, they come back. So when they come back, they tell the rest of the congregation what they saw and what their experience was. Well, in verse 25 and 26, they come and they say in verse 27, we went to land and indeed it does flow with milk and honey. It is the perfect land. It's got everything that, you know, we need or could want. And verse 28, the people, they say, nevertheless, on the other hand, the people who live there are very strong. The cities, they're fortified and very large. And we saw the descendants of Anak there. In fact, we were there and we felt like grasshoppers. To some of these people, they were so big, giants. And we find out later, some of these guys sleep in beds 13 and a half feet long. So some, you can imagine seeing that. I mean, that's pretty big. All right, so they come back. It's a good land, but this is what's wrong. The cities, the people, they're very strong, very large. Verse 29, Amalek is living in the land. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites are in the hill country, the Canaanites. So they tell them where everybody's at, the lay of the nations there. But Caleb quiets the people. The people are getting, at this point, the crowds, you know, can imagine they're getting upset. So Caleb says, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. So Caleb tries to turn the conversation a little bit, or the tone of it, and say, we can go do this. We can go right now. Let's go. God is with us. But the others who were giving the report overwhelmed the congregation. And in a sense, just took all the wind out of their sails. And they lifted up their voices in chapter 14 and they cried out all night long. They were moaning and, you know, what have we gotten into ourselves into? You know, when we decide and make a commitment to God, is there ever going to be times when we rethink that decision? What have I gotten myself into? Well, they certainly did here. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more. We're going to talk about belief and what it means to believe. But here in this instance, they grumbled, they complained, and they criticized the Lord and Moses and everyone who brought them out of Egypt. They were saying, we were better off back then. We've come out here to die in the wilderness. We'd have been better off to die in Egypt. Why has the Lord done this to us? to fall by the sword. We're going to get killed. They're going to slaughter us if we go into this land. They had, at this point right here, they had zero confidence, zero belief that God would take care of them. They thought this was impossible, what God was bringing them to. And they decided, let's pick somebody else to lead us and let's go back. They were ready to give all of it up, ready to go back to Egypt, back to where they came from, and, you know, go back to that life. Well, Moses and Aaron, they, obviously they're just distraught, in this, and they fall on their faces, and Joshua and Caleb tear their clothes because as a sign of complete, and distress and being overcome. And they spoke to the congregation. And Joshua and Caleb said, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. And if the Lord is pleased with us," verse 8, "He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only," verse 9, "do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." So, here are some men with complete confidence and complete trust and belief in God that He would do what He has said He's going to do. The people, on the other hand, are at the point of unbelief. They've come to the point in their life where all of these things have been said, all these promises for this, you know, this year or year and a half or however long, and they've been told this and they've been planning this, and then when it comes time to do it and to implement it and to actually put, it's a big thing to put your life on the line to go into battle. What can happen in a battle? Anything, right? So there has to be a trust, a belief, and 100% confidence that God was going to take care of them and do this. Because, as we find out in a little bit, there was no way that these people could accomplish this task and take this land by themselves. They were too small, they were not warriors, they were just people, they were slaves. There was no way they were going to do it on their own. And that was what their overriding belief was, that we can't do this. And they didn't trust in God. Well, the Lord says to Moses, he's heard all this, and he says, verse 11, he says, "How long will this people spurn me, and how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst?" God is really disappointed with them, that they will not trust. After what He's done and shown them who He is, what He can do, and the promises He's made, they do not believe. Now, And if you were to ask one of these people, and this is just completely assumptions and thinking about it, but if you were to ask one, "Do you believe in God?" What would they say? Well, yeah, but you got to be kidding me. We're about to try to do this. Is that belief? It's not belief, is it? That's not trust. That's not total commitment. But we see that a lot today, don't we? You ask people, do you believe? Yeah. Actions speak louder than words, don't they? They didn't believe. All right. God says, I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them. He's talking about this congregation, the Israelites. I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. He's talking to Moses now. We're just going to do away with them, and we're going to start over. But Moses pleads with God in the next several verses. Moses had to plead with God before, didn't he? Back at Mount Sinai with the golden calf. And he pled for them. And notice just a few of the things that he says here. He says, God, Lord, if you do this, the Egyptians are going to hear about it. Now, what kind of a point did God make back in Egypt with the Egyptians about who he is and what he could do for his people whom he chose? That was a pretty big exclamation point back then, wasn't it? Moses says, the Egyptians are going to hear about this. They're going to tell it. They're going to tell everybody else too. All right? What kind of God is this? Then the nations who hear it, they're going to say, obviously, that the Lord could not bring his people into the land. He couldn't do it. So this is the point that Moses is making. Very good points, aren't they? I mean, sometimes, the exact right things need to be said at the exact right moments. I don't have that gift at all. I usually do the opposite. Say the worst thing at the worst time. But Moses says great, very good things at this point. And God, and he keeps on and he says, verse 19, pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you also have forgiven this people from Egypt, even until now. So Moses pleads for them. And God relents from that. He's not going to destroy them. But is there a consequence to what they have done in this instance? There's a huge consequence. They're not going to receive the promise. God's going to be able to keep his reputation, just like Moses was talking about. But these people who do not believe, who are not committed, who do not trust in God, they are not going to enter the land. They have broken the covenant that they made with God back in Mount Sinai. So they're not going to receive it. So, verse 22, he says, yeah, they put me to the test these 10 times. They have not listened to my voice. They shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. So all of the men in Deuteronomy chapter 2, we see who this is. It's the men of war. So it's all those who were numbered. All those men who were numbered. How many were there? There's a song. 603,550. All right. There's a kid's song that says that. Well, I remember that number. That's the only reason. So all of them, they're going to pass. They're going to die over the next 40 years. The number of days per year, that the, years per day that the spies were in the land. All they're going to die. Who save whom? Joshua and Caleb. Joshua and Caleb, they were committed. They believed. They trusted. And God was going to preserve them, through this. Now, as we think about this, they're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And I always got the idea that they were aimlessly wandering around as I grew up. I don't think they were aimlessly wandering around. I'm not confident. Somebody here may know more than, definitely knows more than me, but whether or not they stayed at Kadesh this whole time, or they did move about, somewhat. But for 40 years, they're going to have to wait, essentially. before they can go into the land, so that all of those can die off. Now, it's interesting. Amos points out in chapter 5, that what was happening during this time, they still kept their gods. They had brought some gods from Egypt. They still kept some and kept them through this time period where they were waiting for this whole group, this whole thousands, 10,000, 100,000, 600,000 people to die during this 40-year period. How many burials are there going to be in 40 years? Man, I mean, it's going to be constant. It's going to be constant. I mean, however many there are total of this group, if you say there's a couple of million, I mean, we're talking about, you know, maybe two-thirds of them, you know, that have got to be gone. So that's what we're going to be waiting on for this period. Now, during this time, there's a few things that happen. Not much. We don't have very much detail at all during this really historically, this very tiny, bit of, time span. But, as you look through in Numbers, chapter 15 has some of the laws. So we've gone through that already and some of the things that happened there. There is a story of one who broke the Sabbath. We actually talked about that back then. He was put to death. And one other thing that's mentioned there, that God wants them to remember Him. Do they have a problem remembering God and His commandments? So one of the things He had them do was on their garments, around the hem at the base, to put tassels. And there would be tassels hanging all around. And that was to remind them. They put these on every day, wore them all the time, and these were to remind them of God and His commandments. So, alright. So chapter 16, one of the things that happened during this wandering in the wilderness, it does happen before chapter 20, but that's about all the information we have on when it happens. But there were three men, Korah being the kind of the leader. Korah was from the Kohathites, of the Levites, and Dathan and Abiram were from Reuben. All right. So, which side of the camp did they? There's no way to remember all that, is there? They were on the south side of the camp. All right, Reuben, the camp of Reuben, remember? And the Kohathites, with the part of the Levi, where were they at? They were right beside, right up underneath. They would have been closer to the camp, right? The families, the clans of Levi, they camped there. Then the camp of Reuben was down further. And that was the way it was situated around the tabernacle. They were on the same location site anyway. Well, during this event, it seems like, and you can read it and determine for yourselves, but it seems like Kohath had moved for himself from living there where he was down into with the camp of Reuben. With these other men. You can read that and make that determination for sure for yourself. But these three men, Kohath, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, they have a problem with authority and the authority of Moses and with God's chosen, with whom God has chosen. And so they come to, they assemble together against Moses and Aaron. This is verse 3. And they say, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So they come up against Moses. Now, do you remember something that happened we talked about Moses' attitude about the whole congregation and his will for them and their place and his place? Do you remember who prophesied? Remember Eldad and Medad? Not your dad, Medad. So you remember it. I'm telling you, you remember that one. So Eldad and Medad prophesied when they weren't really one of the 70 who were chosen. Remember that? And what did Moses say about that? Because Joshua came up saying, hey, they prophesied. They shouldn't do this. Moses said he wished that every one of them could prophesy. What a blessing that would be. But here, they're saying that Moses has exalted himself above everyone else. Moses didn't do that. Who did it? Who exalted Moses? God put him there. Who is Korah, Dathan, and Abiram complaining and criticizing? God. All right. So Moses heard this and he fell on his face because he knows the seriousness of what they're saying. So he says to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, grab your censers, bring your censers, all of you, bring them and fill them with incense, bring them, and we're going to see whom the Lord has chosen. And and at one point he even calls Dathan and Abiram. At one point were off by themselves, Korah was over here or something, and he actually calls for them, Dathan and Abiram, he calls for them to come in this story, and they refuse. They won't come. And Moses is angry with them. And Moses, in verse 15, he's very angry. He says to the Lord, do not regard their offering. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done any harm to them. And so he tells them, present themselves with their censers, the fire pans, with their incense. And so they gather, 250 of them are all there. And so they go over to their tents, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, Korah with them, Dathan and Abiram, their families, wives, children. And Moses presents to them the issue. And he speaks to the congregation. He says, depart from the tents of these wicked men, in verse 26, chapter 16. Depart from these wicked men, touch nothing that belongs to them, or you will be swept away in all their sin. So everyone backs away from the dwellings, their families. And Moses says, by this you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. Moses didn't put himself in this position. In fact, how many excuses did Moses give to not be in this position? All right? If these men die, verse 29, the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. If they die a natural death, then I'm wrong. God didn't send me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up from what that is theirs, from all that is theirs, and they descend into the Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. And as he finished saying it, the ground opens up and swallows them up, their households, the men who belong to Korah and their possessions, so that all that belonged with them were swallowed up. And all of Israel, all the congregation who had stepped back and saw this, verse 34, they cried out, you know, saying the earth is going to, they were afraid, you know, this was going to open up and get everyone. Fire comes down as well, and it kills the 250 who had brought their offering of incense and consumed them. So God punishes them. He cuts them off completely, and doesn't just cut them off. Gets rid of them. Cuts them off. And But the censers that they were using when they brought their offering, God tells Eleazar. Now, who's Eleazar? Aaron's son, right? He's one of the priests. He tells him to get their censers. They're holy, even though they were using them for this purpose. Those are holy items that they were using. Get them, beat them down, break them, melt them down, and make a covering for the Ark of the Covenant. All right? So this was going to be a covering for the Ark of the Covenant. They wouldn't be used for censers anymore, just for this covering. And that was to remind the people of what had occurred and who of God's will in this matter. Altar, I'm sorry. You're right. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. It was the altar, not the Ark of the Covenant. Yeah, because it had its own means of being covered. It was the altar. Thank you. All right. So, the next day, so overnight, everybody sleeps thinking about what happened. Next day, what's the congregation, what's their attitude? They're grumbling against Moses and Aaron, saying what? It's your fault that our brothers died yesterday. And accuses them, criticizes them, and God speaks to Moses and he says, get away from this congregation. Take one giant step back, they're gone. And God's gonna do it this time. He's tired. Can you imagine how tired God would be of this? Just from my, you know, if I put my emotions in it, you know, time to start over with a new people. This people isn't going to work for God's purposes. But Moses and Aaron, and God starts, he starts a plague running through them. And it starts from one side and it's going through. Moses tells Aaron, run, get your censer quickly, put incense in it. Run before the plague. And so Aaron does it. Aaron puts his life on the line. Aaron does it, he grabs it, and he runs and puts himself between the dead and the living as this plague is running through him. And the plague stops. God stops it. But before he does, almost 15,000 were killed, 14,000 700 were killed besides those who died on account of Korah. So, pretty interesting, pretty brave on Aaron's part to put himself on the line. How many times has Moses put himself on the line? It's constant. I mean, it's just like daily for them. Well, so who is God's chosen? So another event occurs, and it may follow real closely on the heels of this, but, you know, if the question is asked, well, who is God's chosen? And God says to Moses in chapter 17, speak to Israel, get a rod from each of the father's household, 12 rods, their staffs, from the leaders, according to the households, write their names on each rod. Take them, put them in the, deposit them in the tabernacle. In front of the testimony, the Ark of the Covenant, where I meet with you. Put them in there, and whichever one of those buds produces a blossom, then that's the one I've chosen. And that's going to be the one. So God is going to show them again whom He has chosen. Okay? And reiterate that. So they do that, they put them in there, and overnight, Moses goes in the next day, Aaron's rod is there, and it has budded. Not only has it budded, but what else has it done? Produced ripe fruit. Was it fig? Almond. Produced ripe fruit on a staff, on his rod. And God says, take this rod, and you're going to keep this and before the Ark of the Covenant, in perpetuity. It's going to stay with the Ark of the Covenant. Later on, it seems to indicate that it was inside. Whether it was inside or laid before it, it was going to be there as a reminder of this event and of God's chosen and of God's will in this matter and of who He has chosen to be the priest and to be the priesthood. All right. All right, we'll move on to chapter 20. And in chapter 20, there's more duties of Levites and different things. We've gone over that. But as the story keeps going, in chapter 20, Miriam dies. And it appears to be pretty soon, pretty late in this 40-year span. And she dies. But the next thing that happens is that the people are out of water. And they assemble themselves against Moses and Aaron. And the people contend with them. And they said, if only we had perished when our brothers had perished before the Lord. I assume they're talking about the event with Korah and Abiram. If only we had died back then. Why have you brought us into this wilderness for us and our beasts, our animals, to die here? And so they're critical, they're complaining again. This time God does not rain down on them, but he provides for them what they need. And he tells Moses and Aaron to take their rod and go to the rock and speak to the rock, so that it will yield water for them. And you'll bring water for them and their animals and everything. So Moses does that, verse 9. Moses and Aaron, verse 10, they gather the assembly at the rock, and they say, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" And Moses lifted up his hand and he strikes the rock twice with his rod, and water comes down abundantly. Now, what did Moses do wrong there? Two things. Yeah, did you hear what he said when he made the proclamation? "Listen now, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Now who's with him? Aaron. So, they're not giving God the credit and God the glory, but what are they doing? "Shall we do this for you?" And God brings forth water for them, and they're preserved as God has been doing this whole time. But in verse 12, the Lord says to Moses and Aaron, now Moses is the one who struck it, but Moses and Aaron were both the ones there taking credit for this, and they're both going to receive the punishment. "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." So they're not going to be able to go into the land. They're going to do all the work and get the people right to the edge, in Moses' case, but they're not going to get to go in. So did God forgive them? Did God forgive Moses? He did. He was with Elijah. It was Moses and Elijah and Jesus. Remember that? Back in the Gospels. At Mount Transfiguration. And so Moses, he was forgiven. Aaron's forgiven. But what was the consequence for their taking glory, for their sin, for not giving God the credit? They're not going to get to go. All right? There's consequences. We can get forgiveness, and God will forgive us for us today as well as back then. He'll forgive us, but what remains? Consequences remain. And we have to live with those. And sometimes it goes on for a lifetime, sometimes more than a lifetime. We really mess up. It causes pain and hurt on other people. For the next generation, and as well as, you know, for our own. Alright, so what happens now is the people are leaving out after, and they're moving and, trekking their way, kind of up the east side, of the Jordan. Let's see if I've got this right there. What was that? Okay. So what they're going to do is they're going to make their way. They're Kadesh Barnea is down in this area, and they're making their way over and going to head up, you know, up the east side here of the Jordan. And one of the things that they want to do is go through the territory of Edom. Well, it's in the pink. I didn't get enough of it on this map. But they're going to go through Edom's territory, but they ask permission. They say, can we go through? Can we go through? We'll repay you for whatever we use. Water, food, anything that we take from you, we'll reimburse you, we'll pay for it. And wanted to make this arrangement for them. What did Edom say? Yeah, no, they didn't. They weren't going to let them come through. Well, you know, when nations talk to nations and conversations don't go too well, what happens sometimes? you know, they'll fight, right? That happens all the time. Well, in this case, God tells them what? Don't fight them. They have received their inheritance. He's given them their portion of land at Mount Seir. And who is Edom? Esau's descendants, all right? So they can't go there. So they have to go a less preferred route. We don't know exactly what that route is, but they're going up this direction. They go around Edom, and they, from Numbers chapter 21 to, Numbers chapter 21, they meet the Canaanites, King of Arad. He comes out to battle them. He comes out to them, and the people say, Lord, if you will give us this victory, everything will destroy their cities, and everything that's in those cities will give to you. And so they do that, and they just say that we will utterly destroy everything in verse 2 and 3. We'll indeed deliver this people, if you will deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And God heard them. So they destroy and defeat the Canaanites here. And the people, after this, the people spoke against God, verse 5, and they say, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? So they have a victory, and then what I can only assume is a little bit of time passes, and they don't have food and water yet that God has given. And so they get thirsty and hungry and they complain. And, you know, it seems to be a bit of a roller coaster for these people in their faith. Well, God is displeased and he sends among them serpents, fiery serpents described either because of their the venom, the bite, or because of their appearance. But they go in among them, and their people are dying when they're bitten by these snakes. And they cry out, and Moses intercedes for the people. And God says to Moses to make a bronze serpent, set it up on a pole, standard, and put it up, and so that when the people are bitten, that they can look to that and recover, be healed. And so he does that, and the people are preserved one more time from their attitudes and sin. Well, they meet again as they are trekking up the side here, as they're going up through here, they meet the kingdom of Sihon, ask the same thing, can we pass through? He says no, and he comes out to battle. Well, the Israelites defeat Sihon, king of the Amorites, right? Try not to get those confused. Amorites and the Ammonites. The Ammonites are off to the right here. The Amorites are in this territory. And they also meet in Bashan, the kingdom of Og, and he's the fellow who was slept on a bed that was 13 and a half feet long. So they defeat both of them on this territory. So what's really only remaining up on the next to the Jordan? Gilead is in between. They'll come back and defeat them later. Moab is down here, and who is that? They're going to leave them alone because they are also kin, and God has given them their portion of land as well. That's all our time. Thank you for your